Hello, it's John Dennis on Monday the 14th of September. Today, the gravy train rolls on. The Guardian survey reveals the bosses of Britain's big public companies gave themselves a 10% rise in their basic salaries last year.
During the long boom years, it became almost predictable order and pay would keep rising. But you would have thought, given the enormous crisis business faced last year, the deepest recession for a generation, that there would have been some moderation. But the big headline figure is that there was a 10% leap in salaries last year, which really quite surprised us.
Also today, the BBC Director General Mark Thompson reveals his plans for a smaller corporation.
A BBC which is more focused on quality, excellence, independence in its news. And I think we are heading towards a world where we may be able to do it in ways which require a narrower range of services.
And the sound of silence inside the world's quietest building.
You start to get a bit, you can get a bit queasy in here because your balance works from the reference, you know, bouncing sound back off things, and because you don't get anything back, you start to float a little bit. So I wouldn't like to work in here for too long.
But before any of that, Bill Overton's got the news.
The General Secretary of the TUC says the recession's still not over. Brendan Barber warns thousands of workers continue to lose their jobs every week. In a speech on the opening day of the trade union's annual conference, he says there's more bad economic news to come, and it's young people that are suffering the most. The housing minister has one solution. He says he'll only give government funding to building developers for new housing if they also offer young people apprenticeships. John Healy hopes to create over 1,000 apprenticeships in the industry within 2 years. More children could fall ill from the stomach bug E. coli after visiting a Surrey farm last month, according to health authorities. The Health Protection Agency defended itself from angry parents who asked why the farm wasn't closed as soon as the first outbreak occurred back in August. The agency says it warned the farm to restrict contact with high-risk animals. 3 children are still seriously ill with the bug. The head of the agency vetting adults who work with children says it won't interfere with parents simply giving lifts to friends' children. Sir Roger Singleton says the public should calm down, as the scheme is simply to stop people found guilty of inappropriate behaviour with children from getting other jobs. One item of good sporting news from the US Tennis Open in New York. While all the British adults, including Andy Murray, were knocked out, 17-year-old Heather Watson from Guernsey has won the girls' singles title as the 11th seed. She's the first British girl ever to win it. And Heather gets herself onto the front of our sports page this morning with a big picture of her raising her racket in triumph. The report reminds us that Andy Murray won the boys' title in the US Open 5 years ago. Otherwise, the most popular sports story in the morning papers is the possible fate of Manchester City footballer Emmanuel Adebayo. He was given a yellow card for his taunting celebration of a goal against his former team Arsenal. The Sun says he's in double trouble for crowd taunt and stamp because he was suspected of deliberately injuring an Arsenal player. The Mirror Star and The Express all think the FA will punish him severely with suspension. On the front pages, the E. coli outbreak at a Surrey farm gets several leads. The Mail talks of parents' fury as they warned their children could be infected. The Mail says 20,000 children are at risk because of what it calls dithering by the health authorities. Our paper leads with its survey on executive pay, while The Telegraph reports an investigation into second-hand cars. The paper says tens of thousands of buyers may not realise a vehicle described as having only one owner may have had many users because it was owned by a rental firm. There's more news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
Last year has seen Britain's top companies lose almost a third of their value thanks to the credit crunch and the worst global recession in decades. But the firm's executives saw their basic salaries leap 10%. That's according to a survey of boardroom pay carried out by The Guardian. With the details, our head of business, Dan Roberts.
The surprising thing is that the pay has continued to go up. I mean, we've been doing this survey for quite a few years, and during the long boom years, it was became almost predictable that boardroom pay would keep rising. But you would have thought, given the enormous crisis that business faced last year, the deepest recession for a generation, that there would have been some moderation. But the big headline figure is that there was a 10% leap in salaries last year, which really quite surprised us.
Did executives compensate themselves for taking lower bonuses by hiking up their basic salaries?
Yeah, that was basically what seems to have happened. Because For a long time, high pay has been defended in the city through being performance linked. So lots and lots of pay is sensitive to share prices, for example. So there's a big crash in share prices last year. And those bonuses have naturally adjusted. But what's happened is that the base salary has gone up to compensate. So the overall picture is down ever so slightly. But what you've seen is some really big rises. I mean, the standout thing for me is the top 10 executives in the country actually saw their total packages, including bonuses, jump by another 10 million. They were up from, it's 170 million last year, up from 140 million in 2007. So up 30 million. And this is including bonuses in a year when share prices have collapsed. I mean, it really beggars belief.
Who's Britain's highest paid boss?
Well, the highest paid boss is a guy that not many people outside the city will have heard of, but he's a well-known figure for us. He's a guy called Bart Becht, who runs Reckitt Benckiser. I mean, not many people have even heard of the company, but it makes all sorts of very well-known household products, everything from sort of Silit Bang to all sorts of household cleaners. Anyway, he's done a very good job there. It's been a very, very profitable story at Reckitt Benckiser, but he is really in a league of his own when it comes to pay. And he's had another stonking year. He got 36.8 million in pay bonuses and perks last year.
Any sign that more women are being allowed in company boardrooms?
Well, not really, no. I mean, we look at this quite closely in the survey, and just one in 15 of boardroom seats are occupied by women. And most of these are the non-exec part-time directors. There's only 22 women who have full-time executive decisions, executive roles in the whole of the FTSE 100. So, and that figure has barely budged for several years, really. There are a few that manage to make the top of the tables, though. I mean, when they do reach the top, they certainly learn the tricks of how to kind of get as much out of the companies as possible. Cynthia Carroll, who runs the mining group Anglo American, was the highest paid woman. She took nearly 4 million home last year, and managers have picked up all sorts of extras for sort of relocation and various things like that. So it's not entirely the men who are up to this.
Many of these companies were imposing pay freezes on staff and, you know, starting redundancy programs, trying to slash costs. How do directors justify paying themselves more than double the rate of inflation?
Well, I mean, this is why I think this particular survey is going to really put the cat on the pigeons, because until now they haven't had to justify it. I mean, there have been a few kind of attempts at this sort of analysis by pay consultants, and they're very much part of the process, and they have focused until now on those share-related bonuses. So they've been saying all it's been working fine because bonuses have naturally adjusted down. And it's only when we've actually kind of done the numbers and looked at base pay and looked at the overall picture as well that this has emerged. So it'd be really interesting to see how this sets the debate politically. We've already had attention turning to the banks for the way that their bonus culture has returned. But now we can look at the boardroom culture across British business, and it looks like that never went away.
Dan Roberts, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website, Decca Aitkenhead interviews Zach Goldsmith at guardian.co.uk/politics. Leo Hickman laments the passing of CFAX at guardian.co.uk/media. And Don McRae profiles the British basketball player Luol Deng. In America, he's bigger than Beckham. guardian.co.uk/sport. The BBC's dominance online and the expansion of its digital TV and radio channels have angered its commercial rivals. It was fiercely attacked last month by James Murdoch of News International, which owns The Times, The Sun and has a stake in B Sky B. Partly in response, the BBC is looking at ways of becoming smaller. In an interview with The Guardian today, Mark Thompson, the BBC Director General, reveals that the corporation may sell off part of BBC Worldwide, which sells the rights to popular shows such as Strictly Come Dancing. Jane Martinson asked him how he saw the BBC's future.
I think the idea of a BBC which is more focused on delivering to the public what the public itself expects fundamentally from the BBC, quality, excellence, independence in its news, reliability, trustworthiness? Absolutely, yes. And I think we are heading towards a world where, because of the way technology is advancing, we may be able to do it in ways which require a narrower range of services. For example, we're already at the edges. Our red button service, the interactive service on television, we are just beginning to reduce some aspects of that service because so many households have got access to interactivity via the web and via their mobile phones, that first rather brilliant form of interactivity may need less services in it than it did in the past. Still a core service, but less than we did in the past. And I think, you know, the key thing is we're on a migration from an analog world to a digital world. Some people want us to step backwards, and some people would say, well, you know, you really should just be a television and radio with just a handful of channels. Mm. I have to say, that's delusional. We're already a digital broadcaster, and the web is as much of a part of what we do in our future as television and radio. So, you know, we're not stepping backwards. But as we move forward, having a greater care and greater focus on how we fit in with the rest of media, given the enormous challenges other media players fit, and also recognising that in this post-switchover world, the public have got many new ways of getting the content, may mean that, yes, we can offer a set of services which are of more value but of less breadth.
So fewer services.
Potentially.
Mark Thompson talking to Jane Martinson. And there's more at guardian.co.uk/media. I'm John Dennis, still to come in Guardian Daily. As European Union leaders meet Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe, are there signs of warmer relations with the EU?
As is often the case, as a Zimbabwean president turned into something of a history lesson about his feelings on where Zimbabwe had been wronged, and he had particular venom for the British.
First, President Barack Obama is considering redeploying troops from the southern region of Afghanistan, where British forces are also engaged, to the eastern border with Pakistan. US commanders think the ability of Taliban fighters to find sanctuary across the border makes it essential to refocus America's military strategy. The proposals, thought to be included in a formal assessment of the war produced by the top US commander in Afghanistan, as our foreign affairs specialist Simon Tisdall explains.
As you know, John, there's been a strategic review of the Afghan policy by the Obama administration, which has been primarily undertaken by the man he appointed as the new commander there, Stanley McChrystal, who's also the NATO commander. And part of that review seems to be consideration of whether they've got the men that they've got there in the right places, whether they should be concentrating more on the eastern border with Pakistan, where a lot of Al-Qaeda and Taliban activity is focused and centred, and less on the south, which has been the area where Britain has been primarily engaged for several years now, and where Britain has maintained that actually the central fight against the Taliban takes place.
So what would be the cost of such a strategy, moving resources to the east from the south?
Well, financially, I can't really tell you, but I think politically it might be quite serious in terms of the possible resistance Britain might put up to de-emphasising the role in Helmand that Britain's playing, and also what the Pakistanis might think about even greater US military pressure, NATO military pressure on their eastern border.
And how might it go down with American voters?
Well, American opinion has been gradually turning against the Afghan war, as it has in Britain and across Europe. As with Iraq, the American public has been slower to express its doubts about this enterprise than was the case in Europe. But they are gradually catching up now with European opinion, with clear majorities saying they don't really think it's worth fighting.
Obama's also planning to give more rights to prisoners being held by the US in Afghanistan. What's the idea behind that?
Well, again, part of McChrystal's strategy review is to try and protect the civilian population, to build up trust with the civilian population, create the conditions of security and stability that would allow economic and political development to take place. And the story in the New York Times appears to be linked to that, which is to say that the detainees in the Bagram base, which is the sort of Asian equivalent of Guantanamo Bay, will have greater rights of representation and the chance to actually challenge their detentions, which they haven't had up to now.
Simon Tisdall. The European Union has hailed a new phase in its relations with Zimbabwe. The first visit by a high-level delegation from the EU for 7 years ended yesterday. But the delegates called on President Robert Mugabe to fully implement a power-sharing deal with the opposition Movement for Democratic Change. And they said restrictions on trade would remain in place while Mugabe's human rights abuses continued. The Guardian's David Smith reports from Johannesburg.
It's the first time members of the EU have visited Zimbabwe since 2002. So it's another of those small indicators that Zimbabwe's pariah status is coming to an end and they're back in the international fold. That said, it should not be overstated because the EU's restrictive measures, as they like to call them, which Mugabe describes as sanctions, are still very much in place. And although there was some discussion of those, there's no sign of those being lifted anytime soon. So it was one of those moments of engagement and at least sitting down and talking about the progress of the unity government in Zimbabwe rather than the country just being purely isolated. And EU officials did have a lengthy meeting with Mugabe himself, which, as is often the case with the Zimbabwean president, turned into something of a history lesson about his feelings on where Zimbabwe had been wronged, and he had particular venom for the British. But the EU have come out of it and said, it's still a mixed picture and there's still a long way to go before we'll consider lifting sanctions.
Meanwhile, David, the opposition Movement for Democratic Change has been celebrating its 10th birthday. Is there much to celebrate?
A tempered celebration. They are delighted to be in existence for 10 years and fighting the battles they're fighting. And there were some people quoted at today's rally saying, for the first time I'm free and I can express myself and so on. And they have a sniff of power in this unity government. But celebration is very much tempered. And it was interesting, Morgan Tsvangirai, the leader of the MDC and the Prime Minister in the coalition government, gave a speech that really had a tone sometimes of defiance and sometimes of exhaustion. And he said, you misjudge me at your peril, and he said that he really felt Mugabe and his ZANU-PF party was continuing to violate the law and persecuting the MDC's members of parliament. So again, it was a sort of mixed picture for them.
David Smith. Scientists in Bristol who need absolute silence to conduct experiments in nanotechnology have constructed underground laboratories that are among the quietest buildings in the world. The Guardian's Stephen Morris paid a visit.
A busy street in Bristol. We're surrounded by noise, the hum of traffic, the sound of a mobile phone ringing, music blaring from a record shop. But just across the road from here, a much more peaceful world is hidden beneath the pavement. It's the University of Bristol's Centre for Nanoscience and Quantum Information. They do all sorts of complex experiments that need absolute still and quiet. So they've buried labs underground, anchored to the bedrock, that are being billed as, possibly, the most stable and the quietest in the world.
I'm Fred Hale and I'm the operational building manager.
Okay, so in here is the soundproof chamber.
So we've effectively got a room within a room.
Oh, I see, it's through there, is it?
Yeah.
We're going into, oh, right.
So again, you leave all your noisy equipment out here.
Right.
And then if you're not too claustrophobic.
Oh, it's like going into a big safe, isn't it? One of those old-fashioned safes from the the bank robber films.
I'll just stick the lights on. If I shut this, you'll notice almost nothing, because
that is lovely and quiet, isn't it?
Certainly you don't get any echoes or reflections. You start to get a bit you can get a bit queasy in here because your balance works from the reference, bouncing sound back off things And because you don't get anything back, you start to float a little bit. So I wouldn't like to work in here for too long, which is why we put the equipment outside and the experiment in here.
So how does it work? These are, it's kind of, it looks like metal little holes in the walls.
Yeah, you've got very deep insulation material, as you can see. Obviously you can't hear it, but you've got this very dense foam.
Right,
which is then sandwiched, and the little holes then just break up the reflections.
Yeah.
So it's not an anechoic chamber, which has got the egg box shaped walls, but it's a soundproof room. And the type of work, people like Professor Daniel Robert is doing lots of work with biosensors and looking at how things like insect hearing can work with such tiny signals, things that we can't measure and work with very effectively with things like electronics. So they're trying to see how we can apply those to technology.
Obviously no buzzing from the lights or anything like that.
No, very quiet. And again, we've got DC task lights in here, which are not in here at the moment, which go here. So we turn off the fluorescent strip lights and we work under DC lights, which don't give out any of this horrible mains hum. And we've still got our very clean electrical power supply, our isolated earth and the other features that the other laboratories have.
So can we just enjoy the silence for a second? It's so rare, isn't it, to have that sort of silence?
Yeah. We're waiting for the first application for someone to come down here from, to come and do some meditation or something, or just to come and think. Can we book the lab out to come and think?
Great. I am getting a bit woozy there. I think we should evacuate. Thank you.
Stephen Morris reporting. Maybe the engineers who designed the Guardian's podcast studios could take note. And there's more in this week's Science Weekly podcast, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Doug Hardy and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.